honey?
Yes.
Better hurry and let me in. Ain't you going?
Where are you going?
Ain't you going?
Where are you going?
To the Reggae Man.
Reggae Music Man?
Oh, my honey.
What?
Oh, my honey.
What?
Let me take you to Alexander's Plan. Plan.
Hello, and welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So today I wanted to start off by reading a poem, actually. And it's not a terribly long poem. It's by T.S. Eliot. Maybe you've read it before. It's called The Hollow Men. And the reason why I want to read this poem is because it kind of falls in line with what we're going to be discussing today. And I think about this poem a lot in a lot of different situations, and I thought I'd just share it with you. So let's go ahead and get to it. It's The Hollow Men by T.S. Eliot. And it starts out with a little byline at the beginning. Mr. Kurtz, he's dead. A penny for the old guy. At least that's how I read it in my head. Alright, here we go. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Leaning together, headpiece filled with straw, alas. Our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless, as wind in dry grass, or rat's feet over broken glass, in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion, those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom, remember us, if not, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom, these do not appear. There the eyes are sunlight in a broken column. There is a tree swinging, and voices are in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate guises, rat's coat, crow skin, crossed staves in a field, behaving as the wind behaves no nearer. Not that final meaning. In the twilight kingdom. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here the stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in death's other kingdom, waking alone at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness, lips that would kiss, form prayers to broken stone. The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here. In this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdoms, in this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the tumid river. Sightless unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of death's twilight kingdom, the hope only of empty men. Here we go round the prickly pear, prickly pear, prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning, between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom, for thine is life is, for thine is the, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. And that poem by T.S. Eliot, when I first read it long ago in my college years, it kind of just, it's one of those poems that just sticks with you. It's one of those poems that you can kind of see in everyday life sometimes. It's a poem, it can be described many different ways, in many different instances. It's best fitting for this novel that we've read, which I'm actually going to break up between a couple of different episodes, because the beginning of the novel, as with many novels, there's a lot to cover, a lot of things to kind of dig out, and I thought this poem was a good opening for the story of Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut. Because it kind of describes, or not kind of, it does describe, I think, on its face, I think it describes kind of a return from World War I, the men that came back, and the men that didn't, the men that died in World War I, in that world war, that clash between great, you might call them great, different kingdoms on the earth, between Germany or the French or the British, and between the United States and all of them. And it's not, this poem is not something to focus on the states themselves, on the oppressors. It's to focus on the man that they sent out into field, or the woman in World War I that would have been the nurse in the field or off the field. It's to show what men came back from the trenches, what they became. They became hollow men. They became the hollow men, like men stuffed with straw. And this is relevant to the story. To the story of course, for Vonnegut, they had just come out of World War II, the second clash between the mighty empires, the mighty oppressors, and something in chapter 3 of this novel kind of seems to, well, at least with me, it seems to ring true to this idea that the great emperors of the different nations, be it FDR or Hitler or whomever you may pick from each nation, they sent men as if those men were machines into battle. And when those men came back, it's like, I forget the guy's name, but I was listening to antiwar.com's podcast with Scott Horton a few months ago. And there's a guy that came back and from Afghanistan, I believe it was, and he said something that also stuck with me, just like this poem and just like so many other things that I've read. He said that they taught us how to kill, they taught us how to murder when we went over there, and they gave us good practice at it. But they never taught us how to stop. They never taught us how to come back into society. And he was alluding there to the fact that whenever he came back from killing and from the murder of innocents over in Afghanistan and Iraq and all the other countries that the United States currently oppresses, the feeling of being hollow, just like in this poem we just read, the hollow men. And then you come to the end of this poem, and the ever-famous ending, the ever-famous four lines, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." And it's because the men, the machines that are sent out to kill the other men and machines for the sake of the elite, these men and machines die alone, as it mentions earlier in the poem, and they exist alone because they've been taught to murder, they've been taught to kill, they've been taught to exist with no expectation of their lives being longer than the next second. And that's what they've been turned into. So we go into this novel with all of these things in mind, because this was written in 1952 by Kurt Vonnegut, player piano. It was his first novel, I believe. I've read that twice now, so I'm beginning to believe it. It was his first novel, and it was really good, if you ask me. It was, for a first novel, because I've read a lot of different, well, authors that we think of as great now, and their first novels are always good, but not great. And this one, I think, was great. In fact, I think I'm going to read more of Vonnegut's works in my spare time, but I think this one is probably one of his best novels that I've read so far. I think I've only read two or three of them, I can't remember, but two or three that I can recall. This is one of his best novels that I've read. And so we're going to kind of go through it now. I have a couple of articles. Let me see if I can get them pulled up here. Here we go. I have a couple of articles I read just to kind of get me in the mindset of recording this episode, and just so I can kind of, you know, I've read it once now, and so I've not gone through it again like I normally would, because it is 35 chapters. It took me all until actually this morning I read the last few chapters. So, I've got the last chapters on my mind, but we'll go through the beginning. And first off, I found an article in the New York Times from 1952, shortly after it was the novel was published. And they compare it to Brave New World, and they compare it to Caesar's Column and The Iron Heel by Jack London. Caesar's Column is by Ignatius Donnelly. I've not read that one. Jack London's The Iron Heel, I read it long ago, but I don't really remember much of it. But they said it had less intensity than other novels like that. Less intensity, surely, and less seriousness than something like Brave New World. Now, that may be true on the face of it. Because they said the author, who was the author here? Let's see. Oh, it doesn't say. That's odd. Oh, no, it does. Okay, Mr. Hicks. I don't know who that is. But, oh, and by the way, the New York Times is only letting me see part of the article unless I sign up for their services, which I'm not going to. So, but they kind of lay out something that I was thinking. It isn't as intense as Brave New World. And if you've read another dystopian, and I know this is kind of the cursed name, Ayn Rand, but it is one of my favorite books, We the Living. It's kind of almost an autobiographical novel about her time there in Soviet Russia. That one also is very intense, and that is one of her first books as well. I think maybe her first book, and it is my favorite, although it is not nearly as well written as any of her other books. So there's a good example as well. But yeah, so in this article they kind of outline it's a little bit more fun and playful. But as I read through it, and I saw the fun, playful nature of this book, but I also saw I saw a lot of themes. As an anarchist, you kind of tend to see things through your own worldview, as we've talked about before. And everything's colored through your own worldview, so maybe you're not an anarchist, let's say. You're going to see it through whatever view you have. Maybe you identify yourself as a Christian. You'll see player piano through the view, through the worldview of being a Christian, or through the worldview of being, you know, whatever it is that you are, a conservative or a liberal or whatever. However you see the world, that's how you're going to see this. But I see it through my worldview of being an independent human being, which is the best way I can describe being an anarchist. Someone who, it's not something that defines me by my, I don't know how to exactly describe it. I don't fly the flag of anarchy and cling to that singular symbol. I may fly the flag of anarchy, but it's more of a symbol that I put out there, but it doesn't define me and my worldview. I have many different. I'm a literary critic, as you might say. Maybe not by profession, but by training. And as you've noticed from this episode already, I have a lot of comparative literature in my mind. So whenever I read this book, so many different things popped into my head. And so, but I picked that poem because I think it's one of the better comparators to this book. So let's get into it, which I should have done already. So through chapter one, you're introduced to the main character. And you see he's continually described as one of the smartest men in the country, if not the world. And he designs, he has designed all of these automated machines. And these automated machines, which is something that people were talking about last year and the year before, how what happens whenever everything becomes automated and no one has a job. And this is a good sort of insight through the eyes of Kurt Vonnegut, who was kind of a goofy guy. If you've ever read anything about him, he was kind of a goofy dude, but very lovable, I think, and very, very well written and well spoken. But through his eyes, we see what the world may be like if this ever comes to pass, this full automation of everything. And it is the things that were discussed last year and the year before by our rulers, so to speak, are the things that he puts into this book. A workforce, which, and things that FDR implemented whenever we, during the Great Depression, the timelines are a little bit skewed, but whenever there were a lot of people out of work, we'll put it that way, during that time, he created the, I forget what they were called, actually, the corp of men that, and women, I think, that would do work for the state because they couldn't find a job. Someone could probably tell me what that is, but I'm too lazy to look it up right now. So you had the government employing people, and then there were the people that had their own businesses. Like in chapter 4, I think it was, he went to get a bottle of Irish whiskey, or a bottle of Irish, as he and his wife describe it, I can't remember what the area of town was called. But anyway, he went to get a bottle of whiskey at this bar, and the bartender he describes as one of the men who found a way to make their own money without relying on the state. And how the elite, like himself, and that is Paul Proteus, if I haven't, I don't think I've said his name yet, who is the protagonist, you might say, for this story. So he goes and visits this bar, and he describes this man, and he says, these types of people, the men that run the bar, that kind of run their own businesses, that haven't been taken over by automation, they look up to people like Mr. Proteus, Dr. Proteus, as he is called. They look up to them as kind of captains of the industry, and as equals. Whereas Paul himself looks down upon these men as sort of useful idiots. I don't think that's how he describes them, but that's the idea I got. And these are the interactions between the elite and the common man. Which leads us to another part of the story, because there's a cutaway from Paul to... actually, I think I have it pulled up here. Let me look. Where's it at? There's a cutaway to another man here. Oh, where's it going? Where's it? Calisandra. Let's see here. Dr. Halyard. Dr. Halyard, a dutiful man with a bad conscience about the size of his expense accounts. So he's bringing a... what's his name? It's Shaw... Cassandra? I don't know exactly how to... Oh no, that's not the Shaw's name. Man, I don't remember these names. It's been about a week since I've read this part, so... Let me get to the beginning of this chapter. The Shaw of Brat Pur, spiritual leader of 6 million members of the Kolhori sect, wizened and wise and dark as cocoa, encrusted with gold brocade and constellations of twinkling gems, sank deep into the royal blue cushions of the limousine like a priceless brooch in its gift box. That is how it opens to discuss the visitor. And they're riding in this limousine. This is connected, I promise. They're riding in this limousine around town and kind of discussing, I guess, Dr. What was his word name? Halyard? Halyard? Oh, I see. Of the United States Department of State. Okay. Yes. So they're discussing. He's kind of showing him around, showing him the automated machines, and probably, I imagine, trying to sell him on them. And at one point, the Shah says, they come upon working men, men working for the state, in fact. And there's a translator there that they have to have a go-between with. But the Shah says, what about these men, these slaves? And Dr. Halyard says, well, no. These are not slaves. These are free men. They have freedom of speech, you see. And they have freedom of religion. And they have freedom of this and that and the other. We give them freedoms. And the Shah smiles. The Shah smiles and he says, yes, they're slaves. And he says, no, not a slave. Or to be precise, what does he say? I don't need to be precise. Oh, yeah. Takaru. Citizen. Okay, so he says, no, they're not Takaru. No Takaru is what he says. He says, citizen. And the Shah says, ah, citizen. And he grinned happily. And he says, Takaru, citizen. Citizen, Takaru. And Dr. Halyard, of course, says, no Takaru. Because Dr. Halyard refuses to see that what he calls a citizen is simply a slave to the state. And why? Because that slave has no other means of supporting himself or herself but through the state. And he is outlining here that the citizen is a slave to the state. And even in his time, and you can see this as kind of even a criticism of FDR's, I can't remember what they're called, but FDR's program where he employed thousands, maybe I think it was even over 100,000 men and women to the state so that they could have a means to life. And this is a criticism of that. Citizen Takaru. Takaru citizen. This is a criticism. And just kind of to show that it doesn't matter what you call it, it's still slavery. And one might look at this and say, ah, but this is also how it is in today's time with corporations. Because, so in my view of the world, my worldview, you might say, I look, how would I say it? I look and I see the state as the same thing. It is the same type of entity as, say, a megacorp like Google or Amazon. And you can make excuses for them and say, well, these people, they have the freedom to choose to work at these different places, and they can change their job if they want. And I accept that. That is true. They can. But at a certain point, you begin to realize, but they must work for someone else. And the system is set up, this economic system of ours is set up so that they must work for, they could work for someone else, like a small business. But in the end, it's all geared to protect and uphold the businesses that the state selects. They work hand in hand, and there is no real, in my opinion, there is no real difference between the state and a corporation like Amazon, or a corporation like Google, or Apple, or any of them. Apple, there is a distinct, I know the others do it, but as well, but there is a distinct example with Apple, where they employ these children over in China and other places, I'm sure, India, to make the chips for all of their devices. And it's been outlined and kind of emphasized by different organizations that this is similar to slavery, if not slavery. And these people, they're miserable, they live in misery. And the argument against that is, but they're richer than they would have been if they had not got a job working for Apple. And that, see, this is one thing that you can't actually deny that. They do have more money now than they would have had if those jobs didn't exist. But that doesn't excuse Apple or Foxconn, I think it is, who actually produces the chips for Apple. It doesn't excuse Apple or Foxconn for controlling the lives of these people so much that they must still live in poverty and eventually commit suicide due to their circumstances. So it's just something to think about as we continue. So the book moves along. Player piano, and here we are at the bar. I know I kind of just skipped a whole bunch of the beginning, but a lot of it is just Paul, the protagonist, going kind of walking around remembering things. There is one poignant little, what would you call it? One poignant little scene where he gets a cat. And it's funny because he's the man who designed, he and some of his friends designed all this automation, but there are rats chewing through cables and damaging the equipment, and so he gets a cat. He finds it on the street and decides, I'm going to use this cat to scare off the rats. And it's funny because, and it's odd because he has all these automated devices, and his first response to a problem like rats is to get something that is not automated. He would get a cat to chase off the mice and rats, and but it's a failure because he brings the cat in and he lets it loose. I can't remember if it was on accident or on purpose, but he lets it loose, and immediately the cat is struck by one of the automated machines and killed. And it's not really funny, I guess, but it is. There is something there. The machines that he created destroy life. Right there in that scene. That small little, I think it may have been 6 or 8 paragraph scene, or a 6 or 8 paragraph scene. The machines he made destroy life. I think that's what's going on there. And he, so he, oh, and the cat, that's right. And he has to chase after the cat because it's been thrown or it's been grabbed, I think, by something and deposited in a trash bin. And he has to chase after it. And then he has one of his people take it away. And he has them deliver it to his office, and it's a whole thing. But you'll have to read it if you haven't already. And by the way, I haven't mentioned, I do highly recommend that if you haven't read this and you're just listening to this, you're not going to get the full effect unless you read this book. And it's on my website, so you can get the EPUB for free off of my website here. So, and that is anarchobook.club. So, but we're moving on. Where was I going with that? Oh, okay, yes, that's right. He has his first encounter with the player piano. And let me bring up my notes here because I had some things about it. Okay, so, and that's whenever he's in the bar because he wants to get a bottle of Irish, like I had mentioned before, for a friend of his that's visiting who is an Irishman and will only drink Irish whiskey. And he goes to this bar and sees a man, and I don't remember his name, and neither did Paul, in fact. Let me see. I'm almost to it in this. Rudy Hertz is the man's name. And he tells Rudy Hertz, he sees this man in the bar, doesn't recognize him at first, until he's confronted with the memory. And he doesn't want to remember, it doesn't seem like. He just wants to get out of that bar after he gets his bottle of Irish. And he's confronted by the man, and the man doesn't have the anger that he expected. The man only remembers the good days when he and Paul were working with their hands, and they were creating things. They were making things, and he remembers that he was very, very good. And Paul remembers as well at that point, says, "Yes, you were one of the best." And it becomes a whole scene about it. But at one point, Rudy reaches over and he says, in a celebratory fashion, he says, "We gotta play some music." And he pops a nickel into the player piano there by the side. And it starts playing some sort of ragtime, Alexander's Ragtime Band. Which I haven't actually looked up. I kept meaning to and I forgot. It's actually here in my notes to look it up and listen to it. Maybe I'll put that as the intro and outro music for this episode. We'll see. Well, you'll already know if it's the intro music, if you hear some ragtime. So, that's the player piano. And it's an old piano. And Rudy makes the comment. He makes the comment. He sees this player piano playing by itself, an automated machine, in a bar that is specifically designed not to have any automation at all, just an old-time bar with a bartender. He makes the comment, "You can almost see the ghost sitting there, can't you? It's kind of creepy. You can almost see a ghost sitting there playing his heart out." And at that moment, Paul twisted free and hurried out to his car. You can almost see a ghost. And then, and that was the end of chapter 3. Chapter 4, it begins with, "Darling," this is his wife speaking, You look as though you've seen a ghost. And maybe that's not the... I think that's supposed to be a stark transition on purpose. I don't think it's a flaw in the writing at all. And maybe this is why the New York Times writer described this as a funny... This is one of the reasons why he described it as kind of a funny, playful novel. But if you've ever read Vonnegut, well, of course, I guess New York Times author never had read Vonnegut if this is his first book. But today, if you've ever read Vonnegut, you know this is his style. It's kind of funny and playful, but also serious. And so she hands him a cocktail, and they have their whole thing here. And he makes a note that everything seems so automatic between he and his wife. And this is another play on the theme of everything being automated. And that got me thinking, and thinking so much that I wrote down a note about it, that all thought and action of humanity at this point in the story is automated. It's automated, and you do as is expected, and you do as your leaders. In our day, you might think Google, Facebook, Amazon, the government. You do as they say. You are their slave. You are the slave under their heel. And let me get back to Takaru. You are Takaru, citizen Takaru, Takaru citizen, as the Shah would say. And you are the slave to the government. You are the slave to the corporation. You are the slave to whomever... to whomever you kneel. And I think that's the point of the beginning, at least. And now it goes into, and we won't get into this today because I want to cover the revolution that occurs in a second episode, because I wanted to focus more on this point here for this episode, the automation. And it made me wonder, in my own life, do I have an automated process? Do I have a series of automated processes that do not improve my life other than the efficiency of my life and of the things I do in my life? I thought about it, and there are some things, but one of the things that freed me from this, that freed me from the problems of what you might call automation, one of the things that freed me from it all was the embrace of, and this may sound like an advertisement for it, but it's not, I assure you, the embrace of free and open source software, community built software, because, and the embrace of Slackware for my operating system. And I know that sounds ridiculous, and it is sort of ridiculous, but I see it as a way to free yourself and free your own mind from just accepting the chains of whatever it is that you use for your daily, for gaming or whatever it is. And maybe it is a bit inconvenient at times, but it's ever growing to be more convenient, and that's through community help and community development. But but that's not the only thing. There are other things. Because, so I read the lines here about his relationship to his wife, Paul's relationship to his wife, Anita, being or feeling automatic and feeling like it's an automatic process and there's nothing there. And I thought about my own life with my own partner. And luckily, most of the time it's not automatic. Most of the time we do make an effort to do things with each other and to enjoy life in whatever way we can. Even during, say, like this pandemic. So you can't go to a restaurant. That's okay. It doesn't matter. We can find things at home to do. You can't do this or that. That's okay. But we can find other things to do. and not become just an automatic process where you're born, you grow up, and you have that normal childhood, or not. You may have a childhood that's horrible as well, but even that can become an automatic thing within your mind. Even that can develop automated processes in your mind, and it does. But you grow up, you get a job, you live your life in an automatic fashion, doing what's expected, and then you die. And then you do that in an automatic way as well, because let's say you get sick and die, you do everything you're told. Not that you shouldn't, but you do. And everything that you're told, you do. Everything that your whole life becomes automatic. And at that point, you may realize at your death that you are a hollow man, or a hollow person, as it were. And death comes, and the end is a whimpering, not a bang. And it's an interesting perspective on the world, it's an interesting look on my own life, because many things about my life were automated, and maybe if they weren't, things would have been different. But that doesn't mean you should regret anything. That means you should go forward with a new plan, with something else, something to look forward to, something, you should pick up a book, per se, and read a book, and expand your mind, expand your horizons, as I remember a poster up from my youth saying, expand your horizons. And that's what I think this story is about, and that's why it's playful. It's engaging. The player piano is the common man or woman, the common citizen, the common takaru. If you become a player piano, as you are expected to become by those that would oppress you, by the big corporations that would hold you down, and by the government who does hold you down at the point of a gun. If you accept all of that and just do as you're told, then you can't be an anarchist, and that's for sure. But maybe you don't want to be an anarchist. But if you just accept all those things and lie down and take it, then you can't expect much from your own life. And your life will go out with a whimper, not a bang. And maybe that's what you want, and that's okay. But if you're here to suck the marrow out of life, as it were, or to climb, what is the old line? From Walt Whitman, I sound my barbaric yop from the rooftops of the world. If you want to do that, which is what I always long to do, it's something I learned in college from my best friend that I met there. It is always to climb the next mountain and to sound your barbaric yop regardless of the consequences, so that you bring some sort of meaning and some sort of purpose to your life, and you take responsibility for your own life, as we discussed in the last episode here. And I think that's what the beginning of this book is. I think that's what the rest of this book is. We've only made it through about a third of it now, but I think we should probably stop there. But we've made it through about a third of it, and then the last two-thirds of it are the build-up, the revolution, and what comes after. But I think we should be able to get through the rest of it in the next episode. But that's what I want to leave you with, that poem. Just read it again. I wish there was a way I could post it in the show notes, but that would make the show notes unbearably long. So I might post a link to it. I found it on allpoetry.com. I might find something a little bit easier to read. But anyway, yeah, so go out, I think. I think after this episode and after this book, after this reading, I'd like to have a call to action to go out and sound your barbaric yop, as it were. To not be one of the hollow men, as Eliot would have us believe. And not become a player piano, where insert a nickel and you'll play a song, a pretty little tune, as it were. Go out, sound your barbaric yop, and, do something new. That's what I take away from the beginning of this. I hope you took something else away from it other than this, and if you did, feel free to contact me. The contact details are on the website, anarchobook.club, and where this episode is posted. But you can find me on Mastodon. You can find me, you can find my email address, and amongst other things, on the website. So give me a shout out, tell me what you think, and I hope you enjoyed reading Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut.
I'm gonna hit.